Welcome back to the 2 a.m. Book Review Club, where we stay up late talking about books or talk about books that made us stay up late. April is over, which means that it is once again time for my monthly wrap-up, where I talk about all of the books I read that month. And since I did a lot of reading in April, I read 20 books, we have a lot to talk about. Apologies if this episode goes a little bit longer than usual. Before we get into the April wrap-up, I do just quickly want to give a shout-out to Jessica, who left me my first ever review on Apple Podcasts. It is a 5-star review, calling this podcast fair-minded, eloquent, and insightful, which is so sweet and also tells me I must be doing something right because those are precisely the three things I always aspire to be. Thank you so much for the review. It really made my day. No, it made my whole week. And knowing that people are listening to and enjoying my content really inspires me to keep going. So, thank you so much for the review, and now let's get into the monthly wrap-up. In April, I read a bunch of mysteries, and I also read a bunch of historical romance, and then I also read a handful of other genres. So, what I think I'll do is I'll bookend this episode with the two biggest categories, mysteries and historical romance, and then in the middle, I'll sprinkle in the books that don't fit into either category. Kicking off this wrap-up with the 8 mystery books I read in April, I think I'll begin with the 2 mystery books that I listened to on audio. The first mystery book I listened to on audio was The Word is Murder by Anthony Horowitz, which is one of those murder mysteries that's narrated by a murder mystery writer. But The Word is Murder takes this premise one step further, because where these types of meta mysteries tend to feature a fictional mystery writer, The Word is Murder is written by Anthony Horowitz, and the protagonist is also Anthony Horowitz. Since this is a novel and not a memoir, the events of this book are obviously completely fictional, but there is something fundamentally disorienting about watching the author weaving together fact and fiction into this almost, but not quite believable, sequence of events that are both grounded in an easily recognizable reality while also falling into tried and true murder mystery tropes that we all know would never ever play out that way in real life. The Word is Murder is a mystery book that fully commits to the bit. I definitely enjoyed the fine line it walks between making meta commentary on murder mysteries while also being a very clever example of the genre. And while there are some aspects of this book I would like like to question or follow up on or explore further if this was an episode dedicated to this one book, this is not that kind of episode. This is my monthly wrap up. So instead, I'll wrap up my thoughts on The Word is Murder by saying that if you're considering listening to the audiobook like I did, I feel like I should warn you that the narrator sounds low key kind of bored, except during the action sequence that happens at the end of the book, which I honestly found kind of hilarious, but I realized that other people might find it a bit annoying. So those are my thoughts on The Word is Murder. The other mystery book I listened to on audio this month was The Soulmate by Sally Hepworth, which I know would technically be classified as a domestic thriller and not a mystery, but I'm sticking it in the mystery section because let me tell you, The Soulmate isn't much of a mystery, it's true, but it is much more of a mystery than it ever is a thriller. The Soulmate is about a woman named Pippa who lives with her husband Gabe and their two young children in a house near a cliff that is unfortunately popular with suicide jumpers. Since moving in, Gabe has gotten into the habit of talking to the suicidal people who have come to jump off the cliff, and it turns out that he's really, really good at convincing them not to do it. Until one night, a woman shows up at the cliff. Gabe goes out to talk to her as usual, and she decides to jump anyway. And when Pippa discovers a connection between Gabe and the dead woman, she starts to question what really happened that night on the cliff. This book, The Soulmate, made me so mad, both because of the level of absolute nonsense Pippa was willing to put up with, and also because at the end of the story, at the end of all of these events, there was no accountability. There were no consequences, and that was just too depressingly realistic for me to personally handle. I do think that Sally Hepworth is an author who is very talented at balancing the mundane details of everyday life with the reveals that are needed to keep the story moving forward, which is not true of all domestic thriller writers. And I did also think that the audiobook was a very pleasant listening experience, but The Soulmate was probably the most frustrating book I read this month, and if I hadn't been listening to the audiobook, I might honestly have DNF'd it because I was just getting so annoyed with Pippa as a character. Now, moving on to the mystery books I actually read with my own two eyes, let's begin with Vera Wang's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers by Jesse Q. Sutanto, which I have been dying to talk about, no pun intended, because I enjoyed this book so much. Our protagonist, the titular Vera Wang, is the nosy, talkative, and kind-hearted proprietor of a Chinese tea shop who wakes up one morning to find a dead body on the floor of said tea shop. And when the police refuse to investigate, Vera sets out on an investigation of her own, finding suspects, collecting alibis, and building up her case for who done it. Vera is definitely the star of her own book, even if she does veer dangerously close at times to becoming a caricature of herself. But a lot of the book actually focuses on the four, I believe it's four suspects. Maybe somewhat surprisingly, my comp title for this book would be One of Us is Lying by Karen McManus, which I know is a YA high school soap opera type mystery. So these books are very different premise-wise, but structurally, these two books have a lot in common. Both books have alternating point of view chapters from each of the suspects, who are all trying to make us feel bad for them while also telling us that they have done a terrible, horrible, unforgivable thing. And both books have endings that you are either going to think are brilliant or are going to cause you to throw the book across the room. Personally, I figured out the ending of Vera Wang's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers long before we got there, but I still really enjoyed spending time with these characters, and I especially enjoyed spending time with Vera. And if you're looking for a fun, fast-paced, cozy mystery, Vera Wang's Unsolicited Advice for Murderers would definitely be one of my top recommendations. The next three mysteries are all books that I talked about in last week's episode. Five random books. Can I predict my most to least favorites? So, if you want more in-depth thoughts on any of these three books, then definitely check out that episode, which I thought was a lot of fun to make, and I hope it's equally as fun to listen to. Book number one is Third Girl, a classic Hercule Poirot mystery by the Queen of Mystery, Agatha Christie. Third Girl opens with this girl who comes to the home of the famous detective Poirot and says that she thinks she might have committed a murder. Then she disappears, and Poirot has to track her down and decide whether or not she indeed committed a murder. Third Girl is fun, twisty, and full of so many moving parts that it will make your head spin trying to keep track of everything that's going on. I don't have a lot to say about Third Girl, but I did enjoy reading it, and generally speaking, that's pretty much all you can ask of a mystery. Book number two is Dumb Witness, another Poirot book by Agatha Christie. And it's one of those mystery books about a rich old lady. Everyone had a motive to kill because, you know, money. Dumb Witness is dedicated to Agatha Christie's dog, and it also features an adorable terrier named Bob, who is easily one of my favorite characters I have come across in a long while. But because this book is from the 1930s, it also contains repeated usage of a racial slur, so reader discretion is definitely advised with this book. Book number three is The Devil and the Dark Water by Stuart Turton, which is a fast-paced action action-packed mystery that takes place on a ship allegedly haunted by a devil named Old Tom. Like Stuart Turton's first book, The 7½ Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle, The Devil in the Dark Water is very cleverly plotted with so many clues and writing craft choices, all pointing you toward the answer, which, by the way, I did figure out around the 50% mark, and I'm very, very proud of that because there was just so much going on. Red herrings galore. The Devil and the Dark Water was definitely a fun time, a very fun mystery book, and I'm very excited about Stuart Turton's upcoming release, Murder at the End of the World. So again, those are three of the books I talked about in last week's episode, so be sure to check that episode out for more in-depth thoughts. And now, let's wrap up the mystery section of this episode with my two favorite mystery books from April, because I did, of course, save the best for last. Favorite mystery book number one is Wrong Place, Wrong Time by Gillian McAllister, which is about a woman named Jen who one night sees her son commit a murder, and then she finds herself going back further and further in time in order to understand who her son murdered and why. So this is a why done it, not a who done it. And what I really, really enjoyed about Wrong Place, Wrong Time was its exploration of the central relationships in the book and its theme of how even when you think you've known someone for years and years, even when you think you know everything there is to know about this person, sometimes it turns out that you didn't ever really know them at all. Wrong Place, Wrong Time is a deeply psychological story, and I really enjoyed the insightful moments that are sprinkled throughout the book. Like, for example, this quote, "Banter can hide the worst sins. Some people laugh to hide their shame. They laugh instead of saying, I feel embarrassed and small." I love moments in books that put into words emotions or thoughts I've had but have never been able to articulate. And Wrong Place, Wrong Time is a book that is full of those moments. This story was tense and intense. It was deeply emotional and heartfelt. And even though I did kind of feel like the ending tied off things a little too neatly, I really could not ask for more out of a mystery book. And if you are looking for a very psychological, why done it type of story, I would definitely, definitely recommend Wrong Place, Wrong Time. Favorite mystery book number two is In My Dreams, I Hold a Knife by Ashley Winstead. Every so often, I get this urge to find a book about a group of rich, beautiful, young, dramatic, stupid, evil kids burning down their rich, beautiful world through their own dramatic, stupid, evil actions. And once I find that book, I will sit down with it and eat it up in one sitting. And that is exactly what happened with In My Dreams, I Hold a Knife. This book is basically about seven kids who go to knock off Harvard. One of them ends up dead, and 10 years later, the survivors reunite and set off a chain of events that reveals who the killer really was all those years ago. There's drama, there's chaos, there's gossip, there's violence. It's basically Gossip Girl, but with more murder. And I enjoyed every nonsensical, over-the-top soap opera moment, because how could I not? I will say that this is not the book for you if you want likable characters, because there is not a single likable character in this entire book. And it is also not the book for you if you care about realism in any way, because none of this is how college or real life works. But if you are just looking for a thriller that will provide you with sheer, unrelenting, melodramatic entertainment, I definitely recommend In My Dreams, I Hold a Knife. So, those are all of the mystery books I read in April, and now let's talk about the books that fit into the genres I read the least amount of. A little bit of fantasy, a little bit of contemporary, a very, very little bit of nonfiction. You get the idea. And I'm going to begin with the little bit of fantasy I read in April. In April, I read two fantasy books, both of which I have already talked about here on the podcast. Fantasy book number one is Emily Wilde's Map of the Otherlands by Heather Fawcett, which is the sequel to the cozy fantasy hit Emily Wilde's Encyclopedia of Fairies. Since I have already talked about this book in its own episode, here I'll just say that if you're looking for a fast-paced, action-heavy fantasy book featuring a grumpy academic, a charming fairy prince, and an assorted cast of quirky side characters, then look no further than this book. In some ways, this sequel does feel like a more action-filled rehashing of the first book, but it also definitely still has the same whimsical charm. So overall, I did enjoy reading Emily Wilde's Map of the Otherlands, even if it wasn't exactly what I expected going in. Fantasy book number two is Piranesi by Susanna Clark. Piranesi is set in an alternate world that is strange, mystical, almost hypnotic, and completely impossible to explain. But that's okay, because the book slowly explains it to you. I talked about this book in last week's episode, but what I loved most about Piranesi is its essentially abstract nature, the way that it engages with you on an almost purely intellectual level. This isn't a book about characters or really even about people, but instead, it's a book that is about ideas and knowledge and the acquisition of knowledge. I'll also add that it's classified as fantasy, but to me, it reads much more like surrealist fiction or maybe magical realism. Either way, I know this is not a book that will work for everyone, but if it sounds like something you might be interested in, I would definitely encourage you to check out Piranesi by Susanna Clark. So, That is my sprinkling of fantasy books for April. And now let's move on to my sprinkling of contemporary books. Contemporary book number one is Remarkably Bright Creatures by Shelby Van Pelt. And this is essentially a slice of life story featuring a very smart octopus named Marcellus, who lives in an aquarium, an older woman named Tova, who cleans said aquarium, and a down on his luck young man named Cameron, who wanders into town looking for his father, a job, and his meaning in life. You know, the small stuff. I did talk about this book in its own separate episode, so here I'll just say that Remarkably Bright Creatures featured a remarkable lack of Marcellus, the octopus, doing interesting octopus things, and a remarkable overabundance of humans doing the most boring human things ever, like making dinner, bargain hunting at the grocery store, etc., etc., etc. Riveting stuff, I know. I see why Remarkably Bright Creatures has such a large and dedicated audience, but unfortunately, that audience is just not me. Contemporary book number two is One Day in December by Josie Silver. And oh boy, do I have thoughts about this book. One Day in December opens with our protagonist, Lori. She is on a bus and suddenly looking out of her window, looking at the bus stop, she sees this man and instantly falls in love with him one day in December. The bus pulls away before she can talk to him, and when she officially meets him months later, it's as her best friend Sarah's new boyfriend, Jack. Thus begins a decade-long saga of drama, angst, and adults refusing to act like adults. I was here for the drama and the angst and the unrequited yearning. I mean, why else would you pick up a book with this premise? But at some point in the story, I discovered that I just did not like the character of Jack, because where Lori does her best to be supportive of Jack's choices, and especially his romantic choices, Jack is comparatively so rude and unsupportive, and at some point, I just could not handle this man's "I want to have my cake and eat it too" attitude. Jack is frankly both selfish and immature, and by the end of the book, I was rooting for Lori to realize that and finally let go of her infatuation that never really had a basis in reality, but then it wouldn't be a romance, I guess. Like Remarkably Bright Creatures, I know One Day in December has an audience, and here's what I'll say. If you loved People We Meet on Vacation by Emily Henry, then I think you will love One Day in December. But unfortunately, neither of those books are books that really work for me. Personally, the rest of the books in this episode all have some association or connection with history. So I'm going to divide the remainder of this episode into three sections: historical nonfiction, historical fiction, and historical romance. I know that most people think historical nonfiction is kind of boring, so the vast majority of you will be happy to hear that there is only one book in this section, and that book is The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. The Splendid and the Vile is a World War II book, so basically the most cliche kind of historical nonfiction, and it is more specifically about the bombing of Britain by Nazi Germany, the way that the British government dealt with a war they were almost sure they were going to lose, and most interestingly for me, this book talked a lot about what life was like for ordinary British people just trying to live their lives under these unlivable conditions. I saw a critic recently call Eric Larson's books dad history, and that is definitely what they are. There is an exhaustive and exhausting amount of detail. Huge chunks of The Splendid and the Vile are just the author quoting various source materials, and you're expected to be interested in a huge cast of characters, as well as everything they said or did or thought within the time frame of this book. And let's be honest here, if I had been reading this book physically, it would have taken me months to get through. Honestly, I don't even know if I would have gotten through it, but I listened to this book on audio, all 18 hours of the audiobook, and I really enjoyed it, partially because I learned everything I could possibly ever want to know about the British home front during World War II, and also because I loved that every other paragraph, the narrator had to put on this deep, rumbly, pompous Winston Churchill voice, and every time he did that, I thought it was hilarious. If you too love ponderous tomes about World War II, The Splendid and the Vile might also be for you, and I would definitely recommend the audiobook, but otherwise, I would probably steer clear. Moving on to our historical fiction section, I have two books. Here's a question for you. Did you, like thousands and thousands of other readers, love The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo by Taylor Jenkins Reid? Because if your answer is yes, then boy oh boy, have I got a book for you. And that book is Did You Hear About Kitty Carr by Crystal Smith Paul. Like The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo, Did You Hear About Kitty Carr is about a fictional Hollywood icon who sacrificed an important piece of their identity in order to achieve their place in film history. In Evelyn Hugo, Evelyn has to hide her bisexuality, and in Kitty Carr, Kitty has to hide the fact that she's actually biracial, half white and half African American. Unlike Evelyn Hugo, where personally I really struggled to connect with the characters, I thought that the characters in Kitty Carr were so interesting and so compelling, and I really, really cared about what happened to them. Like Evelyn Hugo, however, I did feel that Kitty Carr was bogged down by a present-day storyline I simply could not bring myself to care about. It's an incredibly common historical fiction narrative structure to have a present-day storyline running alongside the historical storyline, and if I'm being honest, I have almost never felt like the present-day storyline was a valuable contribution to the overall story. Generally speaking, when I'm reading historical fiction books, I tend to skim through the present-day storyline, hoping that we will get back to the stuff I actually care about soon. And that was, unfortunately, unfortunately also the case with this book. But overall, I did really enjoy Did You Hear About Kitty Carr? I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed The Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. And if you enjoyed Evelyn Hugo, I would definitely encourage you to pick up Did You Hear About Kitty Carr? The other historical fiction book I read in April was The Essex Serpent by Sarah Perry. And I was blown away by how much I loved this book. From the opening pages, this book grabbed my attention and simply would not let go. And I was so immersed in this deeply emotional Victorian saga of people who fundamentally cannot, could not, would not understand each other intellectually, forming these emotional bonds that cause them both so much pleasure, but also necessarily so much pain. I love the language, I love the characters, and I was left an emotional wreck, an emotional mess by the ending. For lovers of historical fiction, I cannot recommend The Essex Serpent enough. Although it does contain some sensitive topics, so please do look into what those topics are if you plan to read the book. I did also discuss this book in last week's episode, so be sure to check that out if you're curious about my other thoughts. And now let's move on to the final section of this wrap-up, which is historical romance. And I am going to discuss these books in order of how much I like the cover, because some of these covers are giving we had no budget, so here's what you get. Starting at the bottom of the rankings, spot number 5 with my least favorite cover is Forever and a Duke by Grace Burroughs. The cover is very simple. It's just a woman in a plain pink Regency dress framed by red velvet curtains. So, what is the issue with this cover, you might ask? The issue is that the cover model's costume is giving Spirit Halloween. The color palette is bland and uninspired. There is entirely just too much white. The pink is not vibrant enough. And overall, the cover for Forever and a Duke has to be one of the most boring covers I have ever seen. The story itself has a fun premise. A handsome duke falls in love with the smart, sharp-tongued, sassy woman who does his accounts, his bookkeeping for his estates. And it's very cute. It's very slice of life with not a ton of conflict or stakes, just two people falling in love while doing math. Personally, I do prefer more passion and angst in my romances, but Forever and a Duke is just a feel-good, very rational, I guess is the word, love story, and there's nothing wrong with that. Moving on to the cover in the number 4 spot, we have the cover for To Taste Temptation by Elizabeth Hoyt. Again, we have a woman on the cover, but this time she is in a scandalously low-cut dress with her hair down, lying over her shoulders. I actually love the color scheme for this cover, the indigo of the dress contrasting with the smoky lilac and white of the curtains behind her. But otherwise, there just isn't much to the cover. It's still kind of bland and forgettable. But Whereas I felt Forever and a Duke was a bit lacking in the passion department. To Taste Temptation is practically overflowing with passion and lust and steamy, spicy scenes that are enough to make you blush. To Taste Temptation is your classic class difference love story with the high-class English lady and the rough, wild American frontier man, complete with my least favorite trope in historical romance, the kidnapping scene. And if I'm being honest, I wasn't really sold on this being the romance of a lifetime, because there were certainly fireworks, passionate fireworks happening between these two characters, but as far as like an emotional and intellectual connection, not really. By the way, this is an older romance from 2008, so there is definitely a dubious consent element and a heaping tablespoon of anti-Native American sentiment mindset. So please do be aware of that if you decide to pick up To Taste Temptation. Moving on to the cover in the number 3 spot, we have the cover for Remember Love by Mary Bella, which features a woman in a deep red dress standing beneath some autumn foliage, gazing at a man on a horse riding in front of a white stone mansion. I love how seamlessly all of these elements, the blurring of the foliage, the spotlight on the dress, the coloring of the author's name, come together to create a cover that is both vibrant, but also somehow a little bit muted, a little bit wistful, a little bit sad, because that is exactly the tone of this story. I picked up Remember Love because I was promised a second chance romance, but what I actually got was two people falling in love over the course of a couple of days. That's about half of the book. Then we have a time skip of 6 years, and then in the second half of the book, these two people fall back in love over the course of a couple more days. There was romance, but there was possibly even more page space devoted to our main male character's family and his family drama, and it was interesting, definitely, but it also wasn't what I was expecting going into the book. Remember Love is atmospheric, it's emotional, and it wasn't what I was expecting, again, but I did enjoy it for the family saga, Regency family drama that it was. All right, we are in the home stretch now. Two more books and then we are done. My second favorite historical romance cover was the cover for Longing, also by Mary Bella, and I am referring specifically to the cover for the 2015 reprint. This is another woman staring longingly at a mansion cover, but what I really, really love about this cover is the color palette. There are so many different colors here. The magenta of the woman's shawl, the vibrant green of the grass, the indigo and the teal and the lime green of the sky, and yet it all comes together to form this cover that is so vivid and yet so soft. I also really enjoyed the story in Longing because it's one of those historical romances that doesn't shy away from the bleak realities of the working class, how nearly impossible it was for them to unionize and institute real lasting change in the face of opposition by the ruling classes and the strict boundaries imposed by class differences. This book was so emotional. It had the most real emotional connection out of all of the romances I read in April. And even though I knew there had to be a happy ending, because hey, it is a romance, I still had tears in my eyes because I simply could not see how we were going to get to Happily Ever After. I loved Longing, but I do hesitate to recommend it because it is an even older historical romance. It's from the 1990s, so there is dubious consent galore, which I don't mind personally, but I do know that it is a sensitive topic for many people, so please do be aware of that. And then finally, my number one historical romance cover is the cover for The Duke's Accidental Bride by Ava Devon. This cover features a man, or titular duke, of course, embracing a lady who is, again, of course, his accidental bride. What I adore about this cover is that it is designed with this lush color palette of blues and golds, one of my favorite color combinations, and the whole thing just exudes 2015 live action Cinderella vibes. So, how can I not love it? As for the story, The Duke's Accidental Bride is, as the title suggests, a paint-by-numbers Regency romance with all of the expected tropes and all of the expected emotional beats. Let me sketch an outline for you of the story in The Duke's Accidental Bride, just so you can see how conventional it is. I had a terrible childhood. I can never fall in love. But oh wait, I think I just did, and I don't know how to react, so I'm going to cause us both needless misery until we are finally forced to marry due to, circumstances. And then we can live happily ever after. If you read Regency romance, you have read this story, and I enjoyed most of it, except for where the author bizarrely decides to describe Johann Sebastian Bach's music as a silly tune and says that his music lacks soul. I'm sorry, are we talking about the Johann Sebastian Bach? Because the audacity of saying that his music is silly and lacks soul is clearly coming from someone who has never ever listened to either Bach's Air on the G String or his Jesu Joy of Man's Desiring. If you can listen to either of those pieces and say that Bach has no soul, then I'm sorry to break it to you, but you have no soul. Also, the epilogue where our aristocratic lady is meeting Beethoven, and he is being all friendly and polite. Are we talking about the same Beethoven who despised the aristocracy? Because if so, then the man is rolling in his grave at the disrespect. And I know it is silly to get worked up over a book called The Duke's Accidental Bride, because it is not meant to be taken as anything other than wish fulfillment. But I had to get it off my chest. And as silly as it is to rant about The Duke's Accidental Bride on a podcast, I feel like it would be even more silly to try to rant about it in real life. So here we are. And those are all 20 of the books I read in April. And wow, this wrap up got away from me. I did not intend for it to be this long. And I did have 20 books to talk about, But for next month's wrap-up, I will strive to make the length of the episode a little more reasonable. And that is going to be everything for this episode. This has been the 2 a.m. Book Review Club. Thanks so much for joining me, and I will be back next week at 2 a.m. Until then, have a great week, and happy book travels.